Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at WBEZ.org/events.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Israeli strikes have destroyed many ambulances and hospitals in Gaza, and the structures that are still standing are out of resources. In the past 6 months, at least 700 aid and healthcare workers have been killed in Israel's assault on Gaza. And that is according to combined totals from the UN and the Gaza Health Ministry. But each day, doctors and nurses continue to show up and do what they can for patients. And that includes doctors from the Chicago area. Dr. Tammy Abuganeim, who practices emergency medicine, recently returned from a medical aid trip to Gaza. Now, for 2 weeks, she lived and worked in Gaza's Al-Aqsa Hospital as part of a team under the World Health Organization. I recently sat down with Dr. Abuganeim, and I started our conversation by asking her to describe the conditions she saw when she first entered Gaza.
The sensory experience is overwhelming. When people tell you that 1.5 million people live in Rafah, which is the southernmost part of the Gaza Strip, that doesn't really convey an accurate idea of what it means to have 1.5 million people living there. The first thing that you notice when you enter the Gaza Strip is that there are just swarms of people. They're everywhere. And one of the very first things that I saw was crowds of children. I mean, they're just roaming the streets, walking around, searching for food, searching for fresh water, searching for a place to sit, trying to shelter themselves from the cold. It's overwhelming to see that many people, but then your other senses are also activated. You're hearing all of the noises that come with that.
Right.
You're smelling, you know, what it smells like for 1.5 million people to exist in this place.
What does it smell like?
A combination of sewage and human bodies and heat, blood, dust, smoke, all of those things really hit you all at once when you enter Rafah.
Wow.
One of the most striking things, I think, that I was not prepared for was just how many displaced people are living in substandard conditions. The tents, if you can call them tents, are handmade, put together, not really effective at blocking out cold or wind or rain. And these are people's homes, and they have been people's homes for months and months. And it's really, really hard to wrap your mind around the fact that there are 1.5 million people living in this condition.
Wow. As you talk about the conditions, Doctor, I mean, we've been hearing since the beginning so many accounts of how difficult it is to get into the Strip to provide aid. Was that also your experience?
Yes. I think I was not aware of how difficult it would be to get in from Cairo to Rafah, the physical journey, but also the journey prior to that. You have to be cleared by several agencies in order to go. So I had to be cleared by the World Health Organization, a nonprofit. We had to be cleared by Israeli and Egyptian authorities in order to get in. So it's quite a convoluted process. Once you have the clearance, you head over to Cairo, and then you take what's supposed to be a 6-hour bus ride over to Rafah. That ends up being closer to 12 hours because of all the stops and passport checks and luggage checks. So it's quite a relief, actually, once you finally get in.
Yeah. We're talking about the surroundings here, but once they enter the hospital, what sorts of challenges are these patients facing?
So these hospitals are functioning as a combination of several things. One is a hospital and providing medical services to patients. The other is a shelter. There are patients in every square inch of these hospitals. In the emergency department that I worked in, there were over 70 people living in the ER. These were people that were patients, but after Israeli airstrikes, they had nowhere else to go because their houses had collapsed and they don't have any family to shelter. And so they live in the emergency department.
You talked in a video diary that you had kept while you were there about the fact that once you treated some people, they would then just go to the hallways.
Yeah.
Because again, they're displaced. There is nowhere to go.
There is nowhere to go. And even the hospital itself is not considered safe. The patients that we would receive after a mass casualty incident, so it would be either an airstrike or a drone strike, or shelling or tanks running people over. We would receive these patients in gushes. And so it would be 20, 30, 40 patients at a time. And sorting through those patients and treating them was one challenge. And then the other is, what do you do with people who have nowhere else to go? And the inevitable solution for Palestinians living in Gaza right now is that you park yourself wherever you find a place that you think is relatively safe. And so patient family members would bring their family in, their injured family in on mattresses or blankets, carry them into the ER, lay them on our floor where we would treat them. And after we finished treating their injuries, they didn't have anywhere else to go. So they would park their mattresses in the hallway, or they would park their mattresses in another ward. And it's just hallways full of people. I mean, you can trip over people just walking on your way from the ER.
But I don't want to miss what you just said. You're treating patients from gunshot wounds. You're doing resuscitations, et cetera, on the floor.
On the floor. Correct. So Al-Aqsa Hospital was initially a 200-bed hospital, and it had about 12 or 14 rooms before the crisis. It has become the trauma center for the middle area of Gaza right now. And so they have had to surge from 200 inpatient beds to 700 beds. The ER is not capable of withstanding something like that. I mean, there are mass casualties multiple times every single day. My first day in Gaza, we had 6 mass casualty events within my first 4 hours. And the gush of patients just keeps coming.
How does this ER compare to other ERs that you've worked in?
There is no comparison. There is absolutely nothing in the world that compares to the emergency departments in the Gaza Strip. Trauma patients are being brought in, lying in pools of not only their blood, but the patient next to them who is bleeding out. They're lying in pools of each other's blood.
Oh my gosh.
You're doing resuscitations and procedures on children who are laying on the floor, and you don't have the equipment to be able to effectively treat them. There is one ventilator in that emergency department.
One ventilator.
Which means that on any given day, you have to basically decide who lives and dies.
And we're talking primarily about children.
Yes.
You mostly saw children.
The vast majority of the patients were children, yes.
How did that feel?
It's traumatizing. It's still very difficult for me to talk about, because these children had parents who had hopes for them. And there were dreams that these parents dreamt for these children. A lot of times the children that we were seeing were recently orphaned. Every member of their family had died. It's difficult as an ER doctor to divorce yourself from that context. So I would see children whose homes had just been hit by an airstrike, whose entire family had just died. We would have to tell them that they were now orphans, that there was nobody in the world left for them. On top of that, we were doing very painful things to them. You know, there were procedures that needed to be done, like chest tubes, amputations, things of that nature. And there is nobody to comfort these children. And so we become their comforters. We become their temporary parents. But after our job is done, we can't do that anymore. And there is nobody else to take on that role.
Dr. Abuganeim, what motivated you to go to Gaza in the first place and provide medical aid?
I could not see the problems of the world and not want to fix them. And I knew that I had the skills to be helpful. I speak Arabic. I'm an emergency medicine physician. I have training in crisis situations. And I felt a calling to be able to provide, in some small measure, relief to both the people of Gaza and the healthcare workers of Gaza. You cannot see these healthcare workers who have been living and working in these conditions for 6 months and not feel a kinship to them. And I think that's true for most healthcare workers. When they see this and they hear about this, they respond with empathy because they understand what it's like working in ERs. They understand what it's like working in tough conditions. And they know that this is extremely difficult for them. Compounded with the fact that these healthcare workers fear for their lives themselves. They know that they could end up in the ERs that they work in. They know that their family members can, and they do end up in these ERs as victims.
Speaking of family, How did you explain this choice to your family and friends?
I didn't. I concealed the fact that I was going to Gaza from my parents.
Where did they think you were?
They thought I was in a camp outside of Gaza in Rafah, the Egyptian Rafah, and that I was helping with medical evacuees. I could not bring myself to tell them that I was going into Gaza. Parents being parents, they were going to freak out, and so I thought it was best to control the anxiety of the situation and fudge the truth a little bit. And so they did not know where I was. I couldn't communicate with them very regularly. Every 3 or 4 days, I would get maybe an hour or two of internet connection, and I would send out a quick message, hey, everything is okay. Mm-hmm. I'm in Egypt, just don't have much connection.
That had to be a difficult decision on your part. I'm also wondering, what if something had happened to you? Had that crossed your mind?
It did. It was a risk that I was willing to take. There is a very significant risk to humanitarian aid workers and healthcare workers that do go into Gaza. It is an active war zone. You never for a minute forget, because there are constant airstrikes, there are drones overhead, you hear the sounds of gunfires, you can hear the sound of tanks in the distance. It's a reality that you just learn to live with, and it's a reality that those healthcare workers there have learned to live with as well. And so I was acutely aware that at any moment my hospital might become a target and that we would have to work through that. I told a few friends, and I told my brother and my sister, so somebody out there did know where I was.
Okay.
I don't think that was very reassuring.
How did your parents eventually find out?
There was a mass casualty event at Al-Aqsa Hospital about 3 or 4 days before I was scheduled to leave. And I didn't know it at the time, but there was a photographer who was taking videos of our resuscitations, and he took a video of me holding a child, laying them on the ground, and resuscitating them and evaluating them. And that video got picked up by a few Instagram accounts and by Al Jazeera. And
so mom found out on social media?
She did.
Wow.
Yeah. So everybody was sending these videos to my mom and saying, do you know that your daughter is in Deir al-Balah, and which is the middle area of Gaza?
Oh, my.
Yeah. And it took her about 24 hours to realize that I had lied to her. And she's still mad. Sorry, mom.
So within the first 2 months, doctor, Israeli bombs had directly hit 14 hospitals in northern Gaza. This is according to a CNN analysis. The World Health Organization has recorded 435 attacks on health systems in Gaza as of early April. Talk more about your mindset around safety.
Everybody in the Gaza Strip is aware that there is no place where Israeli airstrikes cannot find you. That includes hospitals, that includes healthcare facilities, that includes clinics. And hospitals have become a particular target of these Israeli attacks. The devastation to the infrastructure is obvious when you are in the Gaza Strip, from things like not having the proper equipment to not having the staff to be able to work in these departments to not having the specialists that you need to address the problems that start to come up with all of these traumatic injuries and with exacerbations of chronic conditions. In the emergency department that I worked in, we did not feel that on any given day we were ready and capable of giving the care that was needed to our patients. Mm-hmm. And that begins sort of a cycle of almost innovation. You have to innovate in order to get what you need. So people were making things up on the go. We didn't have medications for sedation. We made up drips for that. We would just kind of combine whatever was available. We didn't have morphine, fentanyl, painkillers, ketamine, things like that that we would all use in any emergency department to address traumatic injuries. Those were almost non-existent.
So you were putting all of those medications together?
We were coming up with pain regimens that I could never have conceived. We were using old medications, things like meperidine or pethidine, to address pain. Very insufficient. I mean, these are old medications that we know don't work for traumatic injuries. You can't use this. I mean, in some cases, we're using diclofenac, which is just ibuprofen on steroids, for patients who we were partially amputating. And thank God that the Gazan healthcare staff was able to walk me through this, because otherwise I think I would have been completely paralyzed and frozen and unable to do my job.
You were there last month, and that was when Israeli forces raided Al-Shifa Hospital. Mm-hmm. The Israeli military says that siege targeted Hamas, but according to an NPR report, the acting manager of Al-Shifa named three colleagues who were killed during the raid. What did you hear from other healthcare workers throughout this trip?
So I was working a shift when we found out that Al-Shifa Hospital had been raided, and it came as a complete surprise. Al-Shifa Hospital had been raided several months ago, mm-hmm. and they were just starting to resume providing basic services. It was never going to be the large tertiary hospital that it was, but they were starting to provide basic services. And a lot of my nurses in Al-Aqsa Hospital are displaced from Shifa Hospital. They used to work there. And after the siege, they were displaced to my hospital and they just continued working there. The reaction from them was complete grief. It was like they were grieving for someone that they knew. Mm-hmm. Al-Shifa Hospital to them represented the very best of healthcare in Gaza. And to see this happen again and again and again to their hospital system and witness its total destruction was very personal for them. I mean, there's nothing that feels worse to a healthcare worker than knowing that the place that you worked and the place that could help people is now a target, a military target. And the grief that accompanied that, the rage that accompanied that, was absolutely natural, but it was very much heightened by the fact that we knew that there was nothing that was going to be able to compensate for it. There are 10 partially functioning hospitals in the Gaza Strip.
Right.
The loss of Shifa Hospital is catastrophic to their healthcare system. It's catastrophic to their patients, and it reverberates not only with the healthcare workers, but the patients themselves. They feel it. They were giving their condolences to my nurses, saying, "We're so sorry about Shifa Hospital." I mean, when you think about what it means to them and the way in which it was raided and destroyed, the hospital workers who worked there were telling me that this felt like a personal attack on them.
And as you mentioned, there are 10 partially functioning hospitals. That's data according to the World Health Organization. Last week, doctor, an Israeli airstrike killed 7 aid workers from the nonprofit World Central Kitchen who were providing meals in Gaza. That group was founded by celebrity chef Jose Andres. And President Biden called for an immediate ceasefire in a phone call to Israel's prime minister a few days afterward. I'm curious how you feel about the response to the killing of international aid workers compared to the overall response we've been seeing.
As an international aid worker, this felt quite personal to me. And I think it serves to highlight the ways in which nobody and no one is safe in the Gaza Strip. It is already challenging providing aid in that environment, and to have that compounded by concerns, legitimate concerns about your personal safety, is something that affects you on a very personal, psychological, mental, and emotional level. God rest their souls. I mean, these are people that were doing amazing work. They were trying to feed hungry people. They were trying to stave off starvation. The World Central Kitchen had a good relationship with the Israeli Defense Forces, had a good relationship with the Israeli government. It's right. Part of the reason why they were allowed to scale up their response right. within the Gaza Strip.
They had been several times.
Correct. And even with all of that, even with Israeli forces knowing their exact location, knowing their intentions, knowing what they were doing at all times, even with that, their convoy was struck not once, not twice, but three times.
Yeah.
The death of these 7 aid workers served as a wake-up call, I think, to a lot of Western governments. And it's unfortunate that it took Western aid workers to be able to make people aware of the dangers that accompany humanitarian aid in the Gaza Strip.
The difference in media coverage over this.
Correct. I mean, I did
casualty
not.
Casualty is it's obvious.
Yeah. I mean, I did not hear this level of outrage for Palestinian aid workers that were killed. I did not hear this level of outrage when people seeking to give and distribute flour were targeted by Israeli snipers. It just serves to highlight the fact that for some reason, people have decided that Palestinian lives are disposable. And that includes the lives of Palestinian healthcare workers and humanitarian aid workers. And so when they are killed, no matter what they are doing, that does not receive the attention that Western aid workers receive. And it should not be like that. I mean, we are all working towards the same goal of a ceasefire, of making sure that 1 million people do not starve to death. And everybody's contribution should be counted to that. So if we're going to tell their stories, these World Central Kitchen aid worker stories, we should be able to tell the stories of all of the Palestinian workers as well.
Yeah, what were you hearing from the doctors from Gaza? What did they share with you, right? Because it's not just international aid workers providing this care.
Every single Gazan healthcare worker has novels of stories that they would tell me about their experiences in the war. Every single time I was introduced to somebody who was working in the hospital that day, it would be, this is Dr. So-and-so. He lost 40 members of his family in an airstrike last week. This is Nurse So-and-so. They were detained for 53 days and tortured by Israeli forces when they left Shifa Hospital. This is so-and-so. They lost an arm or a leg or something.
Wow.
Every single healthcare worker that you talk to says they're exhausted. Mm-hmm. They are physically, mentally, emotionally exhausted. They've been doing this for 6 months. They have not been paid. They work their shifts and they go home knowing that they could be next. They don't know if they're going to survive the next hour.
They were also asking you a lot of questions as an American, mm-hmm. right? And same thing with patients that yeah. you were caring for. What kinds of questions were they asking? What was on their minds?
Every person that I was introduced to who found out that I was from the United States would ask me, Doctor, do you know when the war is going to end? Because in their mind, coming from the United States, I must have some information about the trajectory of this war. I must know something about where this is going. And it's heartbreaking to hear that question over and over and over again and not have a satisfactory answer, especially when I know that American-made weapons are being utilized against them. They are aware of that. I am aware of that. Mm-hmm. And they bore me no ill will. I mean, they are very grateful that somebody would choose to come to Gaza to help them, despite the circumstances. They would ask me, do people see us? Do people outside of the Gaza Strip see what is happening to us? Do they see the videos of our dead children? Do they see the videos of destruction? And I would tell them, yes, millions of people are seeing those videos and they're seeing those images and there are protests and there are movements. And they would say, well, why hasn't it stopped then? Hmm. How can all of these people see what's going on and nobody is up in arms about it? How can people let this go on for 6 months? And I don't have an answer for that. And being confronted with that question, I think, was one of the hardest things about being in the Gaza Strip, because you want to tell people that everything is going to be okay. And I know that it is not.
How did it feel to have to leave?
I did not want to leave. It is very difficult to leave people who you know are in danger. And I kept begging my organization to keep me. And I said, give me one more week. Give me 2 more weeks. There is so much work to be done. I can't leave these people. And that was declined for safety reasons and logistical reasons. But I had formed relationships with the people that I'd met. I'd formed friendships with the doctors and the nurses, with the people who were displaced living in the hallways, with the kids. I could not fathom going back to my life in the United States, knowing that I might sometime receive a phone call saying that everyone you know is dead. And I think that's still the most difficult part. It's what haunts me every hour of the day.
Do you think you'll go back?
Yes, absolutely. I have every intention of going back. I can't not go back. How can I see what I have seen and know that I can relieve some measure of suffering and not want to go back?
We've been speaking with Dr. Tammy Abuganem. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for your time.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced and mixed by Max Lubers and edited by Dan Tucker. For more of our coverage of the war in Gaza, head over to wbez.org/reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thank you for listening.
Have you ever wondered why anyone drinks Malort? Or if there are actually lobsters in the Chicago River? Then listen to the Curious City podcast, where we answer all your questions about Chicago and the region. WBEZ's Curious City is part of the NPR network and available wherever you find your podcasts.